In the modes of material nature. Artha, as a fact. Jikvachaha, the seeing and talking of. Yata, just as. Manoratha, mental concoction. Daydream. Svapna, a dream. Sarvam, everything. Indriyakam, produced by the senses. Mrisha, false. Translation. It is fruitless to see and talk of the material modes of nature and their resultant so-called happiness and distress as if they were factual. When the mind wanders during the day and a man begins to think himself extremely important, or when he dreams at night and sees a beautiful woman enjoying with him, these are merely false dreams. Similarly, the happiness and distress caused by the material senses should be understood to be meaningless. Purport by His Divine Grace, Isi Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The happiness and distress derived from the activities of the material senses are not actual happiness and distress. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita speaks of happiness that is transcendental to the material conception of life. When our senses are purified of material contamination, they become atindriya, transcendental senses. And when the transcendental senses are engaged in the service of the master of the senses, Hrishikesh, one can derive real transcendental pleasure. Whatever distress or happiness we manufacture by mental concoction through the subtle mind has no reality. It is simply a mental concoction. One should therefore not imagine so-called happiness through mental concoction. Rather, the best course is to engage the mind in the service of the Lord, Hrishikesh, and thus feel real, blissful life. There is a Vedic statement, Apama somam amrita avuma apsarobir yahama. With reference to such a conception, one wants to go to the heavenly planets to enjoy with the young girls there and drink somarasa. Such imaginary pleasure, however, has no value, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Men of small intelligence worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. Even if by fruit of activity or worship of the demigods one is elevated to the higher planetary systems for sense enjoyment, his situation is condemned in Bhagavad Gita as antarat, perishable. The happiness one enjoys in this way is like the pleasure of embracing a young woman in a dream. For some time it may be pleasing, but actually the basic principle is false. The mental concoctions of happiness and distress in this material world are compared to dreams because of their falseness. All thoughts of obtaining happiness by using the material senses have a false background and therefore have no meaning. Translation again, please repeat. It is fruitless to see and talk of the material modes of nature and their resultant so-called happiness and distress as if they were factual. When the mind wanders during the day, and the man begins to think himself extremely important, or when he dreams at night and sees a beautiful woman enjoying with him, these are merely false dreams. Similarly, the happiness and distress caused by the material senses should be understood to be meaningless. Aumaryanatalapandasya ganajana shalaka chakshurumaditam yena tasmai shivrumena. Shishetanyavadavastamastapitam yena bhutale soyamrupakadamayadatakyaswapadantikam. He Krishna karma sutra dinabandhu jagatate kopesha kopika kanta radha kanta namaste. Tantakam Sadagorange, Radhe Vrindavanishvare, Vishwadamasadevi, Anamani Madhivi, Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Guru Nityananda, Shri Amaita Gavada, Shri Vasati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Nandikashipu is continuing his narration to his aggrieved relatives due to the death of his brother the hands of the Lord. Quoting Yamaraj, speaking to the very attached queens of the Jagjira king who died on the battlefield, showing his prowess. And those queens, so attached to the body of their deceased husband, would not allow him the last rites in that body of cremation, which created a disturbance in the natural rhythms of life and death. And the piteous cries of the queens actually evoked the sympathy of Yamaraj, who came down as a young child to speak words of wisdom. These aggrieved queens. And Hiranyakashipu is repeating the words of Yamaraj to relieve the grief in his own relatives. But actually, we tend in this day and age to become very amazed to hear the basic elementary ingredients of spiritual knowledge from anyone outside of our own entourage of devotees. But really, the knowledge of the eternal nature of the soul as distinct from the temporary nature of the body is not rare. You could probably go to just about any library in the kingdom, in the capital of Maya, which I guess would be America, and find shelves of knowledge regarding the eternal nature of the soul as distinct from the temporary nature of the body. So it's not really a very rare thing to experience such knowledge. What is rare is to come across someone who has realized this truth. So, the theoretical knowledge is available just about anywhere. I mean, we're surrounded by karmis who just think that the body, the pursuit of the pleasures of the body, mind, senses, is all in all. But even then, you can reason with very easily. Just like Hiranyakashipu is doing here with this demon ancestors, and they easily understand by simple analogies that the soul is eternal by nature, distinct from the temporary dreams of the body and mind. It's not very unusual to come across such instructions, such theoretical understanding. What is rare is to come across someone who has realized this knowledge. And there's a major difference in the results of hearing theoretical knowledge and hearing realized knowledge. Realized knowledge means it has been assimilated in the heart. And one who has realized this knowledge can impart it to others and is inclined to do so, because realization awakens the brotherhood of all souls as children of the common Father. And therefore what is inspired to impart this realized knowledge to the suffering masses. Whereas theoretical knowledge is commonly known as crematorium renunciation. And even without words of wisdom being spoken, it is typical that at a crematorium, one comes to realize the temporary nature of the body. And they become detached for a little while, but not for long. Because if that detachment is not based on actual realization of a higher principle, then the senses are just going to find another source of attachment. And this attachment and its nature, Krishna describes in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, verse 63, which is interesting to consider in relationship to the following verse, 64, one being the antithesis of the other. Verse 63, Krishna tells the nature of those who have not realized the basic spiritual knowledge. While contemplating the objects of the senses, one becomes attracted. From that initial attraction, attachment develops. And from that attachment, frustration is inevitable. Because the senses, the objects of the senses, cannot provide any substantial pleasure. They may provide an illusory sense of temporal pleasure, which is itself the source, the seeds of pain. So therefore frustration. And then anger with whoever we identify as being the frustrating agent to our coveted material desires. And then from anger, delusion, bewilderment of memory, loss of intelligence, and fall down again onto the material plane. So what is the use of such theoretical knowledge or such crematorium renunciation, which is short-lived and just leads to further repetition of attraction and attachment? It's basically meaningless. So the antithesis of this trend is given in the following verse by Sri Krishna. By following the regulative principles of freedom, one can attract the mercy of the Lord. And that mercy of the Lord frees one from the dualities of attraction and aversion. Because attraction and aversion are simply the same, different sides of the same coin of material conditioning, which means aversion to Krishna. Conditioned souls become attracted and attached to things that offer the illusion of pleasure. And they're averse to those things which provide the sensation of pain. But the attraction is the source of the pain. So, and both the attraction and the aversion are indications of our aversion to Krishna and the service of Krishna, which is the root cause of our delusions and bewilderment. So, by following the regulative principles of freedom, which basically means the four regulative prohibitions, but the most important regulative principle is to always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. And this doesn't mean some theoretical remembrance. Actual remembrance of Krishna is a result of the blessings of those great souls who have developed that sustained remembrance of Krishna, which is realized in their lives as dedication to the service of Krishna. And in the service of Krishna, considering only Krishna's pleasure, as revealed through the Guru and the Vaishnavas, one is freed from the dualities of attraction and aversion, and attachment and hate. And therefore, he's also freed from the reactions. So, actual realized knowledge comes from Tavide Parivartina Paripasena Sevya, approaching a self-realized soul and inquiring submissively. Submissively means surrendering preconceived notions of what is real and desirable. And most of all, seva, rendering service. It is that rendering of service which is the expression of our will to no longer to reconcile with Krishna, to end our competition with Krishna, our envy of Krishna, which is the root cause of our conditioning. It's the source of our false ego and the illusions of material nature. So, Krishna's pleasure. And not considering our own pleasures or pains or benefits or losses in regards to serving the pleasures of Sri Krishna. And of all those who are surrendered to the pleasure of Krishna, all great devotees acknowledge that the example of the gopis is the best and the highest. Their degree of dedication, sacrifice, and surrender is unparalleled, as in the case of Krishna's fictitious headache, and seeking relief. Narada requested the dust at the feet of the Brahmins to relieve Krishna's headache, and they refused. Never could we place the dust of our feet upon the head of the Lord, because the consequence would be eternal damnation and unending suffering. So they refused Krishna's request. But the gopis, hearing of Krishna's fictitious headache, and the only cure being the dust of their lotus feet, since the Brahmins refused, were immediately prepared to suffer eternal damnation for some temporary relief of Krishna's fictitious headache. Similar is the case. Of course, this is the mood, the example of love, which Lord Chaitanya came to experience for himself, and in so doing to share with the world. So, in Mahaprabhu's Leela, such a wonderful personification of compassion revealed in the prayers of Vasudeva Dutta, who prayed to Mahaprabhu that my heart breaks to see the sufferings of all these conditioned souls. So, if you could answer my prayer by transferring all their karma, whether it's suffering upon my head, then let me suffer eternal damnation and bondage if they can be delivered. That will be my highest satisfaction. And hearing this prayer, Mahaprabhu's heart just melted and tears flowed from his eyes. And he said, "This is not so astonishing considering that you are none other than Prahlad Maharaj. But if that is your desire, that the universe be delivered, it will be so, because Krishna's desire is to please his devotees. But you will not have to suffer the consequence, because Krishna can absolve the sufferings of the living entities and all their conditioning, if that is the prayer of his pure devotee. Because Krishna's main concern is to serve his servants, please them in all respects." This is love. And love is expressed in sacrifice. And what does sacrifice mean? The desire to do anything that is pleasurable to the beloved. And the desire to forsake anything that is imagined to be desirable to our own selfish interest, which is our own enemy, our selfish interest. So, in the material world, karmas are the category of those who seek to exploit material nature due to attachment. Gyanis are those who renounce due to aversion. Whereas the devotee accepts and embraces everything and everyone. And that kind of dedication leads to the realm of Krishna's confidence in Krishna's birth. We have the wonderful example of the sacrifice performed by Vasudeva when his brother-in-law Kamsa, in an instant, transformed from the most respectable gentleman driving a chariot to his newlywed sister and brother-in-law. When one line of prophecy spoken from the sky about how her eighth child will be the cause of your death, and in an instant, he drops the reins, draws his sword, grabs her hair, and is ready to behead his beloved sister, right in the middle of her marriage ceremony. And Vasudeva was pleading with him, "This is not a very gentlemanly thing to do, and people will not think very highly of you." But so selfish was his mentality that he could not be dissuaded by reason. So Vasudeva had to promise, "I will hand over children, if there are any, and you can do with them as you see fit." So Vasudeva, true to his word, handed over all the children to be slaughtered just after their birth. So after the sacrifice that Mataji goes through, months of pregnancy, the pain of childbirth, and then seeing and interacting with a child who she'd never seen before, being within her womb, and the attachment and the natural and proper maternal sentiments to be ripped away and slaughtered before their very eyes. Inconceivable sacrifice. But true to his word, Vasudeva, every year, handed over to the children. So, it was after this whole course of events started to change, just after Aristasura was sent, because Kamsa suspected that Krishna and Balaram were actually the seventh and eighth children of Vasudeva Devaki. They did not really have any direct proof of this. But he was sending his demons. He sent Aristasura, the personification of Aristotelian logic, is it? Trying to fathom and bring Krishna within the three-dimensional limitations of one's own grasp. And that old demon was liberated by the loving hands of Sri Krishna. And the deliverance of Aristasura marks the beginning of the end of Krishna's Raj Leela, which was Narada's cue to go to Kamsa and tell him that actually Jashoda gave birth to a girl, not a boy. And the boy who she's raising, as well as the boy that Rohini is raising, are Devaki's seventh and eighth issue. So, the child prophesied to kill you is flourishing in Vrindavan. Now, Kamsa had suspected this, but nobody that he didn't actually have the proof before. And as soon as he heard these words, he stepped outside of the view of Narada and drew his sword to go kill Vasudeva and Devaki. But Narada stopped him and said, "No, don't kill them. Because then Nanda Maharaj will find out and he'll flee with Krishna and Nala." So, and don't tell Vasudeva that you know what I've just informed you, because he will tell Nanda Maharaj and he'll also flee if he just hears that we know that you know what's going on. So on some pretext, just imprison them, Vasudeva Devaki, again, and arrange a grand festival, because Krishna likes festivals. And as part of the festivities, make a special wrestling arena and make it so attractive that Krishna would be in a very sportive mood and want to wrestle. And of course he told his elephant keepers and everything to make all arrangements to kill Krishna at every possible opportunity. So what wonderful affection and compassion Narada Muni is showing, having incited Kamsa to kill Krishna, to imprison Vasudeva and Devaki. But he knew that if he had them imprisoned, then Krishna would come and rescue them, and then he would receive blessings from Vasudeva and Devaki. So Narada actually showed his compassion by informing Kamsa of the truth that he had not yet realized. So then Kamsa told Keshi, who in Brajalila is the personification of pride. And it's interesting to understand his nature, because the supreme mercy of Krishna is personified in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And by his mercy, one can actually make rapid advancement on the path of sadhana. And if one thinks that his rapid advancement is due to his own merit or glory, he develops the mentality of a wild stallion, such as Keshi, who thinks he can just gallop right into Vrindavan on his own accord. But what does he meet? When Keshi was, galloping into Vrindavan, so huge was this horse that his mane was scattering the clouds and throwing the airplanes of the demigods, out of their orbit. And his whinnying was terrifying and terrorizing the whole countryside, and his thundering hooves was like earthquakes causing miscarriages amongst all the pregnant Pantages. And then when he came galloping into Vrindavan, actually Krishna didn't kill Aristasura. He considered Aristasura so abominable. Because Krishna, it was just twilight time and Krishna was ready for Rasa Leela, but here comes Aristasura. I mean, it was actually very beneficial because it provided the opportunity for Radha and Shanakam to be excavated. But Krishna considered him so abominable that he wouldn't even kill him. And according to Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, Krishna just wrung him out like a wet sponge and then threw him away. You know, after he tried to kick him, he grabbed his hoofs, spun him around, just threw him away. And he wouldn't even kill him. He considered his soul degraded. And Yamaraj appeared and killed him. Krishna was so disgusted with this demon, he couldn't even show him the respects of killing him. So then here comes Keshi. Now, Krishna likes for our pride to become fully mature so they can be completely destroyed. So when here comes galloping in Keshi, Krishna held out his hand and said, "You want to eat something?" You know, if you watch Tampa Prinsburg with his new mule, he tries to make friends with him. He holds out his hand with some nice grain soaked in molasses. Let's make friends. That's exactly what Krishna did himself. Keshi galloping towards him to kill him. He held out his hand. Do you want to eat something? And he just came galloping up. But according to Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, Maharaj Pariksit would have been too disturbed if he heard that Krishna's lotus-like hand and his lotus-like arm had to go into the horrible mouth of this hideous demon and be scratched by his rakshasa teeth. So actually what happened is that Krishna's hand, his tender, delicate, cooling, soothing, lotus-like hand, because as we approach him, he reciprocates accordingly, became like a red-hot iron ball, which first of all knocked out all the carnivorous teeth in this rakshasa horse. And then Krishna's lotus fist, glowing like molten iron, just slid right down his throat, and he met with the burning quality of Krishna, which was the appropriate redemption for his pride. And then he fell dead. And then Kamsa saw he had to go through with Narada's advice to have this wrestling festivity. So Kamsa was so learned in the art of kama and artha, of securing personal interest by political endeavor, and you know, acting like a friend when you're actually just trying to use someone. So he told Akura that, "Look," and he pointed out with his own hand, "I have a brand new chariot." And he was thinking that Akura is like, you know, most conditioned souls who love to get a new car and immediately want to take it for a test drive, as if a new car needs a test drive. So, when Kamsa pointed out to Akura, "Look, I have a new chariot. Want to take it for a ride? Go to Vrindavan and bring Krishna and Balaram to the great festival we're about to celebrate." So Akura was able to understand this is the will of the Lord, because he understood he was going to be drafted into bringing Krishna and Balaram. But he could not ask them to get on a chariot that had been used by Kamsa. That would just be too abominable. So when he saw that, by divine arrangement, he was being offered a brand new chariot. He said, "Well, this, then I can give Krishna and Balaram a ride. And then I'll see, you know, the deliverance of Vasudeva and Devaki and all these wonderful things." So then he went to Vrindavan, meditating on Krishna and Balaram. And, you know, the history thereafter, they came, killed Kamsa, released Vasudeva and Devaki. And in the wrestling arena, Krishna revealed himself according to the rasa in everyone's heart, thus fulfilling the desires and revealing himself accordingly to everyone's realization. So, oh, and Narada Muni, he actually had to go invite Krishna and encourage him to come to Mathura. So Narada Muni, knowing that, okay, Krishna's Raja Lila is ending, it's completed, he asked him, please come and fulfill the desires of the devotees of Lanka. And he informed Krishna that as Yogesh, the master of all mystic potencies, you can both come to Mathura and stay in Vrindavan, so nobody's really going to be bereft of your association. But Krishna said, don't you know that I act according to my own sweet will? So why are you asking me to do something? And Narada told him, because you are the super soul. And as a super soul, you inspired me to ask you. And I know the general sequence of your leelas, having been through them so many times, which is just like a general outline. But I want to see in the future your potency and the potency of your pure devotees, which assists and empowers the devotees to transcend the influence of the illusory energy. So after this, Krishna decided to have one more game in Vrindavan, so they played the game of sheep and shepherds and thieves. And Vyomasura was an unexpected, uninvited thief who wasn't playing the game according to the rules, but was taking the cowherd boys and putting them in a cave. And then as he put them in one by one, he put a big boulder over the mouth of the cave to suffocate them. And then, you know, Krishna realized that there's fewer and fewer boys playing the game every minute till there's only four or five left, and something is wrong. These cowherd boys, I mean the sheep and the shepherds and the thieves are all disappearing. What is going on? So he detected a demon playing the part of a thief, and he suffocated him. As we approach Krishna, he reciprocates accordingly. He wanted to suffocate Krishna. He wanted to end the cowherd boys. He was suffocated. So, but conversely, for devotees, if we approach him, not necessarily in love, because we may not have love for Krishna, but the assurance is that bhakti is absolute, the divine energy of Krishna. The means and the goal and the path and the destination are all one and the same. So how to try to please Krishna and invoke his love if we're feeling bereft of that love? Same thing, 264. By following the regulative principles of freedom, this sacrifice of following regulative principles for Krishna's pleasure, that attracts the mercy of the Lord, which we have rejected since time immemorial due to our selfish desires and false ego. And we again attract that mercy into our lives by sincerely following the regulative principles. And how does that mercy manifest? By freeing us from the attractions to imagined pleasures, the aversion to imagine pain, which is all a dream, as Srinath Kashyapu is explaining here. This imagining ourselves to be the body and things in relation to the senses as being desirable or undesirable is all a dream. There's a night dream and there's a day dream, but it's all illusion and has nothing to do with reality. So the mercy of the Lord, which is attracted by sincerely following the regulative principles, frees us from these dualities of attraction and aversion, which perpetuates our bondage and illusion, and begins to bring some light into the dungeon of our conditioned existence. The mercy of the Lord also means divine intervention, which is essential. Because the plight of Vasudeva and Devaki is something like the plight of all living entities, even devotees in this material world. We're incarcerated. Vasudeva and Devaki were placed into a prison. And Kamsa was helpful because he is fear personified. That fear of material conditioning kept Vasudeva and Devaki fixed on the mercy of the Lord, which took birth in there from their pure hearts and freedom from that dungeon of Kamsa's prison. So the descriptions of the scripture are literal. The pastimes of Krishna aren't reality. There is no reality other than Krishna, his pastimes, his holy name, his devotees and devotional service. Everything else is a grand illusion. In material existence, we have taken assistance from Maya and created a dungeon with walls so formidable that it is impossible to escape the network of our own conditioning. Any endeavor to become free simply further entangles us in the web, like a spider web, of material existence. When a bug gets trapped in a spider web, he gets stuck. And he tries to free himself, and gets more stuck. He tries harder. He's finally so incarcerated, he's lost. So that is the nature of the living entity's endeavors to free himself. He has created this dungeon with walls, impenetrable. And it's dark inside. Which means the light of transcendental knowledge is blocked by our own false ego. So the mercy of the Lord is essential. When Haridas Thakur was explaining the various stages of chanting the holy name in the assembly of the Madhundars, there was a discussion going on about liberation. And they asked Haridas Thakur to speak. And he said that liberation is not the fruit of the chanting of the holy name. Liberation, sought after by the jnanis, is the dim reflection of Namabhas. And he explained that Namabhas, the dim glimmer of reflection of the illuminating rays of the holy name, is like the pre-dawn indirect light. The sun's rays have not yet crested the horizon, but the indirect infusion of the rays, which are over the horizon, dispels some of the darkness and gloom of the night. And then you can just barely begin to make out forms in the night. And then you begin to see what's there and what's not, and your fear of the unknown and ghosts and demons and thieves and undesirable fearful things, it's diminished when you see, well, they're not there. They were just, you know, imagined in fear. But there's just enough light to see what's actually there. And then when the sun actually arises above the horizon, that's like shooting up. Namabhas gives liberation from all the fears and attachments and aversions to conditioned life. Namabhas. Shuddhanam reveals everything in its actual nature. And what is the actual nature of the world? Since our perception is that of either night dream or daydream, we do not even perceive the actual nature of the world we live in. And therefore, we have the scripture, and we have the guru. And Srila Prabhupada told us, don't try to see through your eyes, which are so deceptive. See through your ears. because transcendental sound emanating from the spiritual world has the ability to awaken remembrance of the spiritual world within our hearts. It has the ability, transcendental sound, to penetrate into the darkness where none of the other spiritual senses can make contact to the reality. The transcendental sound has this ability to bring an image from far away and reveal it within our hearts. So, the nature of reality, and the nature, the actual nature of even the phenomenal world, as it is beautifully described and portrayed by Srila Prabhupada in his Illuminations of the Bhagavat, which is something he envisioned printing with Illuminations before he even came to America, and was invited to a conference in Japan where he knew there would be artists available. He wanted to go to have the artists do paintings of Illuminations of the Bhagavat. And what is the text? It is Shukadeva Goswami's description of the natural beauty in Vrindavan in the rainy season, and what lessons we can glean from the natural order of Braj. So Braj Lila is the revelation of nature in its most pristine beauty and glory and purity and meaning. But even material nature is a reflection of that divine nature. And material nature, it has substance, even though it's temporary. The substance is not something to enjoy or renounce, but is something to learn from. The substance of the material world is it that it imparts lessons. The beauty of material nature is that it points to something beyond itself, of which it is just a reflection. And the reflection, just like the namabhas, is very meaningful and very useful into leading to the pure vision and realization. So everything in the material world is meant to teach us something about our eternal nature. But to decode the message of material nature requires submission to one who actually sees things as they are.